Someone on New Hampshire Public Radio last week when I was listening mentioned this event and said that this was sort of like the New Hampshire Poetry All-Stars. And I have to say that I agree with them. I think it's significant that all four of our poets tonight, who are, I must say, among the best in the state, about which we're also excited, and I must say that we also appreciate them donating their time to the project. All of them chose to live in New Hampshire rather than arriving here through an accident of birth, which says something about our state, I think, and about what it does to the creative process. Our first reader tonight, and I'm very pleased to introduce him, is Donald Hall. When I first came to New Hampshire, I thought there were three or four guys named Don Hall who were writing all these things. And to my shock, it was one person, and he lived in Danbury or Willamott, depending on when you talk to him and depending on where the next ham and bean supper was, I think. But Don grew up in Connecticut, but spent his summers on his grandparents' farm in Danbury or Willamott, wherever it is. And that site has been a locus for much of his poetry. He has published children's books. He's won the Caldecott for his children's book, The Oxcart Man. He's published the classic, I think, String Too Short to Be Saved, a classic reminiscence. He's published a collection of his short stories and books of poetry, including Kicking the Leaves, The Happy Man, and The One Day, for which last year he deservedly, I think, won the National Book Critics Circle Award. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Donald Hall.
Thank you. Thank you, and we're very happy to be here in support of the project. Us writers need all the help we can get, and thank you all for coming here tonight. I can't see you now, but I believe you're there. Just lately, I have been working hard at putting together a book which will come out next August, which is called Old and New Poems, which is really a kind of collected poems. I don't want to call it that. I leave out a good many poems that I published in my first book and some of from my second book and so on. But it really is going to be all the poems I can bear to keep around. And I've had to decide what poems I can bear to keep around and what poems I am pleased about. In the process of doing it, I've found some poems that I'd forgotten about. And I want to begin by reading really two that I'd sort of forgotten about, one of which, I'd more than forgotten about. And after I read it, I will tell you a story about it and my relationship to it. I don't want to beforehand, you'll understand why I don't want to beforehand. It's a poem that's called The Clown, and I think I wrote it about 1958, 59, something like that. It starts, it's a kind of interview with the clown. "Practically all you newspaper people," the clown said, "get it badly mixed up with sentimental junk. But you are a chap with an intelligent face. I am not crying on the inside. I am no brave faker. On the contrary, I am a simple laugh. And the laugh pretends to be about nothing in particular, and not the answer to anybody's especially difficult question. Nor do I pretend that the world is really, in its deep center, utterly pleasant or lovely as a joke, or that it feels good to be crucified. Laughter is the sign of an emotion that is like other emotions, but more transient and less related to the problems of the man who displays it. It is my specialty, and all laughs are mad laughs. I realize that I could argue that these red polka dots are spots of blood and that I laugh to explain them. But any reason is a false reason. Polka dots are as crazy as polka dots, or as the light heart itself, which suddenly laughs in the shuttered room that is real and unhappy, where the old without chances talk to the young without hope. men dying of cancer even, lift for a second in their hollow bodies no hope but a lightness like air. They don't stay lifted. What will stay lifted? If even for men dying there is my madness, who puts me out of work? The clown cartwheeled across the dressing room and bowed. I found a number of poems that I've, you know, left out of books, but this is the strangest one. Because about 20 years ago, the New Yorker published its New Yorker Anthology of Poetry. Now, when the New Yorker buys a poem, when you sign the check, you sign a little contract that says that they can reprint it in any damned anthology of their own they want to, and they don't even have to consult you. So when the New Yorker Anthology arrived in the mail, I didn't know that it was coming. I didn't know I was in it, etc. So I looked back in the index immediately, and there I was with a few poems, and they had left out the two best poems I'd ever published in the New Yorker, but they had printed a bunch of them, and I looked down, and I said, oh, that one, and then I saw one called The Clown, and I thought, I never wrote a poem called The Clown. And I turned to the page, and I began to read it, and I was so amused. The New Yorker is so persnickety about accuracy, you know. And here they were publishing a poem that, you know, it's a terrible poem, that I'd never written. And when I got about three quarters of the way through, I remembered it. You know? And I hadn't looked at it since that time. And just now, when I was putting together the collected poem, I decided I ought to look at that one again. And then I looked at it and I decided I liked it. That maybe the New Yorker had been right in the first place. You know, horrible to admit, but anyway. If you don't agree, just, you know, don't tell me. When I read it at that time, it was a time when I was writing mostly tiny poems of fantasy, mostly. And this was a poem with abstraction and thought and so on that I couldn't abide. Well, another one that I found is a poem that I did put in a book, but I had not looked at it or thought of it for a long, long time. And when I found it, I decided I liked it. This is a poem that came out in a book, 1971, I think it was. But I had not seen much of it for the last 10 or 15 years. It's called The High Pasture. I am the hounds, I am the fox. I wake reassembling torn muscle and fur to run again on the raw fields to a corner of stone. I twitch, awake with the crazy, intolerable scent of me in my nostrils. Yet I am also the leaf that breathes slowly in sun by the wooden bridge at the end of the pond in the high pasture. Now I'd like to switch to something more recent and read one of my portions of the one day, a section called Prophecy. This is a book-length poem that just came out a year ago, and the first and third parts are sort of straight through, but there's a middle part, which is four separate poems called Four Classic Texts. And this is one which is called Prophecy. I will strike down wooden houses. I will burn aluminum clabbered skin. I will strike down garages where crimson Toyotas sleep side by side. I will explode palaces of gold, silver, and alabaster, the summer great house and its folly together. Where shopping malls spread plywood and plaster out, and roadhouses serve steak and potato skin beside Alaska king crab. Where triangular flags proclaim tribes of identical campers. Where airplanes nose to tail exhale kerosene. Weeds and ashes will drowse in continual twilight. I reject the old house and the old car. I reject Tory and Whig together. I reject the argument that modesty of ambition is sensible because the bigger they are, the harder they fall. I reject Waterford. I reject the five and dime. I reject Romulus and Remus. I reject Martha's Vineyard and the slam dunk contest. I reject leaded panes. I reject the appointment made at the tennis net or at the 17th green. I reject the professional bowler's tour. I reject Mac by matchboxes. I reject purple bathrooms with purple soap in them. Men who lie awake worrying about taxes, vomiting at dawn, whose hands shake as they administer Valium, skin will peel from the meat of their thighs. Armies that march all day with elephants past pyramids and roll pulling missiles past generals weary of saluting and past president emperors splendid in cloth of gold. Soft rumps of armies will dissipate in rain. Where square miles of corn waver in Minnesota, where tobacco ripens in Carolina and apples in New Hampshire, where wheat turns Kansas green, where pulp mills stink in Oregon, dust will blow in the darkness and cactus die before it flowers. Where skiers wait for chairlifts wearing money, low raspberries will part rib bones. Where the drive-in church raises a chromium cross, dandelions and milkweed will straggle through blacktop. I will strike from the ocean with waves of fire. I will strike from the hill with rain clouds of lava. I will strike from darkened air with melanoma in the shape of decorative hexagonals. I will strike down embezzlers and eaters of snails. I reject Japanese smoked oysters, potted chrysanthemums allowed to die, Tupperware parties, Ronald McDonald, Kaposi's sarcoma, the Taj Mahal, Holsteins wearing electronic necklaces, the Algonquin, Tunisian aqueducts, Phi Beta Kappa keys, the Hyatt Embarcadero, carpenters jogging on the median, and betrayal that engorges the corrupt heart longing for criminal surrender. I reject shadows in the corner of the atrium where Phyllis or Phoebe speaks with Billy or Mark, who says that afternoons are best, although not reliable. Your children will wander looting the shopping malls for 40 years, suffering for your idleness, until the last dwarf body rots in a parking lot. I will strike down lobbies and restaurants in motels, carpeted with shaggy petrochemicals, from Maine to Hilton Head, from the Skagit to Tucson. I will strike down hang gliders, wiry, adventurous boys. Their thigh bones will snap, their brains slide from their skulls. I will strike down families cooking wild boar in New Mexico backyards. Then landscape will clutter with incapable machinery, acres of vacant airplanes and school buses, plows with seedlings sprouting and turning brown through coulters. Unlettered dwarves will burrow for warmth and shelter in the caves of dynamos and Plymouths, dying of old age at 17. Tribes wandering in the wilderness of their ignorant desolation, who suffer from your idleness, will burn your illuminated missiles to warm their rickety bodies. Terrorists assemble plutonium because you are idle and industrious. The whippoorwill shrivels and the pipperel chokes under the government of self-love. Vacancy burns air so that you strangle without oxygen like rats in the biologist's bell jar. The living God sharpens the scythe of my prophecy to strike down red poppies and blue cornflowers. When priests and policemen strike my body's match, Jehovah will flame out. Jehovah will suck air from the vents of bomb shelters. Therefore, let the Buick swell until it explodes. Therefore, let anorexia starve and bulimia engorge. When Elzira leaves the house wearing her tennis dress and drives her plaque Porsche to meet Abraham, quarrels, returns to husband and children, and sobs asleep, drunk, unable to choose between them. Lawns and carpets will turn into tar together with lovers, husbands, and children. Fat will boil in the sacks of children's clear skin. I will strike down the nations, astronauts and judges. I will strike down Babylon. I will strike acrobats. I will strike algae and the white birches. Because professors of law teach ethics in dumb show, let the colonel become president. Because chief executive officers and commissars collect down for pillows, let the injustice of cities burn city and suburb. Let the countryside burn. Let the pine forests of Maine explode like a kitchen match, and the Book of Kells turn ash in a microsecond. Let oxen and athletes flash into Greece. I return to Appalachian rocks. I shall eat bread. I shall prophesy through millennia of Jehovah's day until the day reddens over cities. Then houses will burn, even houses of alabaster. The sky will disappear like a scroll rolled up and hidden in a cave from the industries of idleness. Mountains will erupt and vanish, becoming deserts, and the sea wash over the sea's lost islands, and the earth split open like a corpse's gassy stomach, and the sun turn as black as a widow's skirt, and the full moon grow red with blood swollen inside it, and stars fall from the sky like windblown apples, while Babylon's managers burn in the rage of the Lamb. I'm going to end with one very brief and quite different poem, a little poem which is called Scenic View. And this is a poem that takes its name from the Highway Department's kindness in realizing how stupid we are, so that they interrupt the good vista with a little sign. Every year the mountains get paler and more distant, trees less green, rock piles disappearing, as emulsion from a billion Kodaks sucks colors out. In 15 years, Monadnock and Kearsarge, the green mountains and the white will turn invisible, all tint removed, atom by atom, to albums in Medford and Greenwich. While over the valleys, the still intractable granite rears with unseeable peaks, fatal to airplanes. Thank you.
I should mention that in the interest of the late start this evening, we've foregone, or we will forego, the 15-minute intermission that's on your programs. The next reader that I have the distinct pleasure to introduce also lives in Danbury or Wilmot. Do you know Donald? Jane Kenyon is a native of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and indeed attended the University of Michigan, where she received the Avery and Julie Hapwood Award for Poetry. She is a 1981 National Endowment for the Arts Fellow, a 1984 Council on the Arts, New Hampshire State Council on the Arts Fellow. She has published her own books of poetry, of course, From Room to Room, The Little Boat, The Boat of Quiet Hours being the latest. She will read tonight from her newest book of poetry, which will be released next fall, Let the Evening Come, which is being published by Grey Wolf Press. She also has been published in a number of magazines, including the Paris Review, The New Republic, and The New Yorker. And I hope that she doesn't shoot me for dragging up this quote, but I couldn't resist. She once told an interviewer for a newspaper article that she loves to publish in places like The New Republic and The New Yorker because, she said, "I love to think of people sitting in a dentist's office who are about to undergo pain, picking up The New Yorker and reading a poem of mine and forgetting where they are for a moment." I think that's one of the best reasons I've ever heard for writing poetry, Jane Kenyon.
I think we all remember what rejection slips look like. I know I do. So we poets have to stick together. I'm going to begin with one called The Letter. Bad news arrives in her distinctive hand. The cancer has returned, this time to his brain. Surgery impossible, treatments underway. Hair loss, bouts of sleeplessness and agitation at night, exhaustion during the day. I snap the blue leash onto the D-ring of the dog's collar, and we cross Route 4, then cut through the hayfield to the pond road, where I let him run along with my morbidity. The trees have leafed out, only just, and the air is misty with sap. So green, so brightly, richly succulent, this arbor over the road. Sunlight penetrates in golden drops. We come to the place where a neighbor is taking timber from his land. There's a smell of lacerated earth and pine. Hardwood smells different. His truck is gone. Now you can see well up the slope, see ledges of rock and ferns breaking forth among the stumps and cast aside limbs and branches. The place will heal itself in time, first with weeds, goldenrod, cinquefoil, moth mullein, then blackberries, sapling pine, deciduous trees. But for now, the dog rolls, jovial in the pungent disturbance of wood and earth. I summon him with a word, turn back, and we go the long way home. The Pear. There is a moment in middle age when you grow bored, angered by your middling mind, afraid. That day the sun burns hot and bright, making you more desolate. It happens subtly, as when a pear spoils from the inside out, and you may not be aware until things have gone too far. How far is too far? All of us know the joy of spring and the kind of wild pleasure of spring. I tried to capture that in this poem called Ice Out. As late as yesterday, ice preoccupied the pond, dark, half-melted, waterlogged. Then it sank in the night, one piece, taking winter with it. And afterward, everything seemed simple and good. All afternoon, I lifted oak leaves from the flower beds and greeted like friends the green-white crowns of perennials. They have the tender, unnerving beauty of a baby's head. How I hated to come in. I've left the windows open to hear the peepers' wildly disproportionate cries. Dinner is over. No one stirs. The dog sighs. sneezes, and closes his eyes. One called Father and Son. August. My neighbor started cutting wood on cool Sabbath afternoons, the blue plume of the saw's exhaust wavering over his head. At first, I didn't mind the noise, but it came to seem like a species of pain. From time to time, he let the saw idle, stepping back from the logs and aromatic dust, while his son kicked the billets down the sloping drive toward the shed. In the lull, they sometimes talked. His back ached unrelentingly, he assumed, from all the stooping. Sundays that fall, they bent over the pile of beech and maple, intent on getting wood for winter, the last, as it happened, of their life together. I'm reading entirely tonight from my new book. It will come out next fall from Grey Wolf. It's called Let Evening Come. One called At the Winter Solstice. All right, I'll try. The pines look black in the half light of dawn. Stillness. While we slept, an inch of new snow simplified the field. Today, of all days, the sun will shine no more than is strictly necessary. At the village church last night, the boys, the shepherds and wise men, pressed close to the manger in obedience, wishing only for time to pass. But the girl dressed as Mary trembled as she leaned over the pungent hay, and like the mother of Christ, wondered why she had been chosen. After the pageant, a ruckus of cards, presents, and homemade Christmas sweets. A few of us stayed to clear the bright scraps and ribbons from the pews and lift the pulpit back in place. When I opened the 100-year-old Bible to Luke's account of the Epiphany, black dust from the binding rubbed off on my hands and on the altar cloth. One called Lines for Akhmatova. I was in Leningrad last October, her city, Leningrad, and it was very exciting to me to be there, to be in the place where she did her work, where she grew up and did her work. Lines for Akhmatova. The night train from Moscow, beginning to slow, pulled closer to your sleeping city. A sound like tiny bells in cold air. Then the attendant appeared with glasses of strong tea. Stand up, ladies, this is Leningrad. The narrow canals gleam black and still under ornate street lamps, and in the parks, golden leaves lie on the sandy paths and wooden benches. By light of day, old women dressed in black sweep them away with birch stick brooms. Your work, your amorous life, your scholarship, everything happened here, where the party silenced you for 25 years for writing about love, a middle-class activity. Husband and son, lovers, dear companions, were imprisoned or killed, emigrated or died. You turned still further inward, imperturbable as a lion gate, and lived on stubbornly, learning Dante by heart. In the end, you outlived the genocidal Georgian with his mustache thick as a snake. And in triumph, an old woman, you wrote, I can't tell if the day is ending, or the world, or if the secret of secrets is within me again. Now, this next one I wrote very much, I consulted Akhmatova, let's say, when I was writing this. I thought to myself, well, what would she do? And she helped me. Heavy summer rain. The grasses in the field have toppled, and in places it seems that a large, now absent animal must have passed the night. The hay will right itself if the day turns dry. I miss you steadily, painfully. None of your blustering entrances or exits, doors swinging wildly on their hinges, or your huge unconscious sighs when you read something sad, like Henry Adams' letters from Japan, where he traveled after Clover died. Everything blooming bows down in the rain, white irises, red peonies, and the poppies with their black and secret centers lie shattered on the lawn. Don and I traveled to Charleston, South Carolina. Was it last spring?
Two years ago,
just to have a holiday, just to sort of park and walk. And several things came together. And here they are, at the Public Market Museum, Charleston, South Carolina. A volunteer, a daughter of the Confederacy, receives my admission and points the way. Here are gray jackets with holes in them, red sashes with individual flourishes, things soft as flesh. Someone sewed the red silk cord onto that gray sleeve as if embellishments could keep a man alive. I have been reading War and Peace, and so the particulars of combat are on my mind. The shouts and groans of men and boys, and the horses' cries as they fall, astonished at what has happened to them. Blood on leaves, blood on grass, on snow, extravagant beauty of red. Smoke, dust of disturbed earth, parch and burn. Who would choose this for himself? And yet the terrible machinery waited in place. With psalters in their breast pockets and gloves knitted by their sisters and sweethearts, the men in gray hurled themselves out of the trenches and rushed against blue. It was what both sides agreed to do. With the dog at sunrise. Although we always come this way, I never noticed before that the poplars growing along the ravine shine pink in the light of a winter dawn. What am I going to say in my letter to Sarah, a widow at 31, alone in the violence of her grief, sleepless and utterly cast down? I look at the lithe pink trees more carefully, remembering Stephen, the photographer. With the hunger of two, I take them in. Perhaps I can tell her that. The dog furrows his brow while pissing long and thoughtfully against an ancient hemlock. The snow turns the saffron of a monk's robe, and acrid steam ascends. Searching for God is the first thing and the last, but in between such trouble and such pain. Far up in the woods where no one goes, deer take their ease under the great pines, nose to steaming nose. I'm going to end with the title poem from the new book, Let Evening Come. Let the light of late afternoon shine through chinks in the barn, moving up the bales as the sun moves down. Let the cricket take up chafing as a woman takes up her needles and her yarn. Let evening come. Let dew collect on the hoe abandoned in long grass. Let stars appear from east to west and the moon disclose her silver horn. Let the fox go back to its sandy den. Let the wind die down. Let the shed go black inside. Let evening come. To the bottle in the ditch, to the scoop in the oats, to air in the lung, let evening come. Let the arm slip from the arm of the chair. Let evening come. Let it come as it will, and don't be afraid. He will not leave us comfortless. So let evening come.
Goodness. Our next reader, and if I keep saying, I could probably keep saying it's my distinct pleasure all night, so I won't say this is my distinct pleasure, but I think that she knows it is our present New Hampshire Poet Laureate. I failed to mention that Don is our past New Hampshire Poet Laureate, but then on the other hand, how many kudos can one take? So. On the other hand, but of course, the same could be said for Maxine Kuhman. She's a native of Philadelphia who now lives atop a hill in Warner with her husband Victor, and is it six horses now, Maxine? Four, sorry. And numerous other fauna, which provide her with inspiration. She has said in the past that she gets great inspiration from her hilltop in Warner, New Hampshire, and anyone who has read her poetry or read her essays on country living know the truth to that. She has served as a consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress. She is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize in poetry for her 1973 book of poetry, Up Country, Poems of New England. She is the author of four novels, seven volumes of poetry, in addition to Up Country and to her most recent book of poems, Nurture. She has written seven volumes of poetry, as well as a collection of short stories, and In Deep, an excellent collection of country essays. She is currently working on more poems and more essays of the ilk of In Deep, paperback editions of Nurture and of her book Ground Time have just recently been released. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce Maxine Kuhman.
I had planned to start tonight by reading a poem from the collection The Long Approach. It got sold before I got here. And also the one copy of Ground Time that I had planned to read from also got sold. So is anybody out there in possession of these who could quickly send? Oh, great, great. That would be terrific, if you don't mind. I'll give it right back. I wanted to start with the poem which serves as a prologue to The Long Approach because it's a found poem, and it always seems like a good idea to read a poem that you didn't really write yourself at a poetry reading. I found this poem in a pamphlet that's published by the Canadian Minister of the Environment, and it gets handed out in all of the Canadian national parks in the Pacific Northwest. It's an admonitory pamphlet called You Are in Bear Country. And the poem really is lifted out of the pamphlet, except it does turn, as you will see, at the end. But most of the language in the poem came right out of the pamphlet. They've been here for thousands of years. You're the visitor. Avoid encounters. Think ahead. Keep clear of berry patches, garbage dumps, carcasses. On woods walks, bring noisemakers, bells, clap hands along the trail or sing. But in dense bush or by running water, bear may not hear your clatter. Whatever else, don't whistle. Whistling is thought by some to imitate the sounds bears make when they mate. You need to know there are two kinds, Ursus arctis horribilis, or grizzly, and Ursus americanus, the smaller black, said to be somewhat less likely to attack. Alas, a small horribilis is difficult to distinguish from a large americanus. Although there is no guaranteed life-saving way to deal with an aggressive bear, some ploys have proved more successful than others. Running's a poor choice. Bear can outrun a racehorse. Once you're face to face, speak softly. Take off your pack and set it down to distract the grizzly. Meanwhile, back slowly toward a large, sparsely branched tree. But remember, black bears are agile climbers, in which case a tree may not offer escape. As a last resort, you can play dead, drop to the ground face down. In this case, wearing your pack may shield your body from attack. Courage, lie still. Sometimes your bear may veer away. If not, bears have been known to inflict only minor injuries upon the prone. Is death by bear to be preferred to death by bomb? Under these extenuating circumstances, your mind may make absurd leaps. The answer's yes. Come on in. Cherish your wilderness. The rest of the poems I'm going to read are from, oh good, here's wonderful. All right, quick change of plan. I think I will go on and then come back to ground time. You know, they say the poet has one song and sings it over and over, and there's obviously some truth to that because there are two bear poems in the new book, and I'm going to read both of them, I think. This one is called In the Park, and it picks up where the last one left off with man prone on the ground. You have 49 days between death and rebirth if you're a Buddhist. Even the smallest soul could swim the English Channel in that time, or climb like a 10-month-old child every step of the Washington Monument to travel across, up, down, over, or through. You won't know till you get there which to do. He laid on me for a few seconds, said Roscoe Black, who lived to tell about his skirmish with a grizzly bear in Glacier Park. He laid on me, not doing anything. I could feel his heart beating against my heart. Never mind lie and lay. The whole world confuses them. For Roscoe Black, you might say, all 49 days flew by. I was raised on the Old Testament. In it, God talks to Moses, Noah, Samuel, and they answer. People confer with angels. Certain animals converse with humans. It's a simple world, full of crossovers. Heaven's an airy somewhere, and God has a nasty temper when provoked. But if there's a hell, little is made of it. No long-tailed devil, no eternal fire, and no choosing what to come back as. When the grizzly bear appears, he lays down on atheist and zealot. In the pitch dark, each of us waits for him in Glacier Park. One more. I have to look and find out where this is, though. One more bear poem, and this is actually autobiographical. Warner, New Hampshire, is not exactly Colebrook, but we do have a lot of black bears. And I had just read a wonderful essay by John McPhee, one of my favorite essayists, in which he had said, black bears are not particularly interested in flesh. They have been seen in the fields eating string beans. And then this happened, and I call it Encounter in August. One of the nice things about reading a poem to a New Hampshire audience as opposed to a Manhattan one is that you don't have to gloss Kentucky wonders or what a teepee is. Inside the teepee that admits sunlight to the underpart, he stands eating my Kentucky wonders, downs pod after pod, spilling the beans, the ones I'd saved for shelling out this winter, thinking soup when he'd gone deep, denned up. This is not Eden, which ran unfenced and was not intercropped. Eden, where frost never overtook a patch. We stand 10 yards apart, two omnivores not much interested in flesh. I think he ought to smell me through his greed or hear my heart outbeat his steady chomp, but nothing interrupts his lunch. At last, he goes the way the skunk does, supreme egoist, ambling into the woodlot on all fours, leaving my trellis flat and beanless. And yet I find the trade-off fair, beans and more beans for this hour of bear. Thank you. I'm going to read two memorial poems for a dog we lost in April. This is an early one. This was a notably enthusiastic dog who did this every year. It's called The Hermit Meets the Skunk, and the hermit is me. The hermit's dog skitters home drunk with it once every fall, the whites of his eyes marbled from the spray, and his tail tucked tighter than a clamshell. He contracts himself to a mouse under the hermit's bed. The hermit unsticks him with a broom and ties him outside to a tree. He is a spotted dog, black rampant on white. And as the hermit scrubs, the white goes satiny with lava soap. The black brightens to a bootblack shine. Next, a dose of tomato juice stains the white like a razor cut underwater and purples the black, and after that, the whole dog bleaches moon-colored under a drench of cornstarch. The hermit sniffs him. Skunk is still plain as a train announcement. So he is to be washed again, rinsed again, powdered again, until the spots wink out again under the neutral white. Inside his mouth, the hermit knows, and knows from what is visible under the tail. Dog is equally spotted, but in the interior, gray on a pink field. If he were to be pinned down, his four legs held at four corners and slit open by the enthusiast, the hermit knows the true nature of dog, spotted layer by layer, would be laid bare. Afterward, all night, skunk sleepwalks the house. Skunk is a pot of copper pennies scorched dry on a high flame. Skunk is a porridge of dead shrews stewed down to gelatin. Skunk is the bloat of chicken gut left 10 days to sweeten in the sun. Skunk is the mother bed, the ripe taste of carrion, the green kiss. And the other poem I wanted to read for our lost, lamented Gus, is this one. It's called Custodian. Every spring when the ice goes out, black commas come scribbling across the shallows. Soon they sprout forelegs. Slowly they absorb their tails, and by mid-June, full-voiced, announce themselves. Enter our spotted dog. Every summer tense with the scent of them, tail arced like a pointer's but wagging in anticipation, he stalks his frogs 200 yards clockwise around the perimeter of this mucky pond, then counterclockwise, an old pensioner happy in his work. Once every 10 or so pounces, he succeeds, carries his captive north in his soft mouth, uncorks him on the grass, and then sits head cocked, watching the slightly dazed amphibian hop back to sanctuary. Over the years, the pond's inhabitants seem to have grown accustomed to this ritual of capture and release. They ride untroubled in the wet pocket of the dog's mouth, disembark in the meadow like hitchhikers, and strike out again for home. I have seen other of his species kill and swallow their catch and then be seized with violent retchings. I have seen children corner pollywogs in the sun-flecked hollow by the green rock and lovingly squeeze the life out of them in their small fists. I have seen the great blue heron swoop in time after wing-slapping time to carry frogs back to the fledglings in the rookery. Nothing is to be said here of need or desire. No moral arises, nor is this probably purgatory. We have this old dog, custodian of an ancient race of frogs, doing what he knows how to do, and we too, taking and letting go, that same story. Okay, just two more. I'm going to read the title poem and one other. Title poem, of course, is Nurture. From a documentary on marsupials, I learn that a pillowcase makes a fine substitute pouch for an orphaned kangaroo. I am drawn to such dramas of animal rescue. They are warm in the throat. I suffer, the critic proclaims, from an overabundance of maternal genes. Bring me your fallen fledgling, your bummer lamb. Lead the abused, the starvelings into my barn. Advise the hunted deer to leap into my corn. And had there been a wild child, filthy and fierce as a ferret, he is called in one 19th century account. A wild child to love, it is safe to assume, given my fireside inked with paw prints, there would have been room. Think of the language we two, same and not same, might have constructed from sign, scratch, grimace, grunt, vowel, laughter, our first noun, and our long verb, howl. And I'd like to close with this is a little poem that's set in Europe outside of Geneva. It's called We Stood There Singing. On a gray day in March in his first year, we drove up out of orderly Geneva, mother and daughter and the daughter's child, up the hairpin turns of the Chasseral in search of the horses of the Franche Montagne, with feathered fetlocks and manes blown wild, each splashed white face the same kind eye said to persist unchanged since Charlemagne. The baby slept tipped sideways in his chair, slept through sudden snow squalls that blanked the alpine road like a stage scrim, and woke up cranky in Les Brûleurs, where at the village's one store we stopped to take our bearings. When he howled, the aproned woman invited us back past vats of sauerkraut and wheels of cheese into their bedroom. I remember that plain space of rough white plaster, oaken crucifix, oak beams overhead, runner of tatted lace on the chest of drawers. I remember the lambskin she unrolled on the bed, motioning you to lay him down. And after he was done up sweet with powder, she opened her arms and bounced him chortling around the room, singing him bits of Le Bon Roi Dagobert. We stood there singing. I remember that moment of civility among women. Thank you.
The next speaker I have the pleasure to introduce tonight is Charles Simic. Charles is a native of Yugoslavia, where he grew up one step ahead of both the German army and the invading Russian army. In fact, he once told me in a conversation we had that Hitler and Stalin were the two great travel agents of his life. To our good fortune, their influence sent him to New Hampshire, where he is today a professor of English at the University of New Hampshire. Charles Simic has won awards for his poetry and for his literary translations from the American Academy of Arts and Letters and the Poetry Society of America. He has won the Edgar Allan Poe Award, the Penn Translation Prize, a Guggenheim Foundation Scholarship, and not at all the least, because it's last on this list, a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. Most recently, he has published his collection of prose poems, The World Doesn't End. And come the spring, he will release an expanded volume of his selected poems, 1963 to 1983. In the same conversation in which he mentioned his travel plans, Charles told me, speaking of the influence of New Hampshire on his work, "Here in New Hampshire," he said, "I have something totally opposite from my memories. I think the two together, grating against each other, create interesting ideas and thoughts and poems." It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Charles Simic.
Thank you. I'm going to read from a book that is going to come out next year, again in the spring. It's a new volume of poems. The book is called The Book of Gods and Devils, and it has a section of sort of autobiographical poems. They go back to, the events in the poems go back to 1958, when I moved from Chicago to New York City. And for reasons that I still don't quite understand. I don't really know why I moved. But anyway, I did move. And so all of a sudden I realized there was this very mysterious period in my life that I really, this Charles Simic was like a character, in somebody's book. So then I felt free to write poems about him. And the number of poems are here for their titles, names of writers and philosophers, books that I was reading at the time. The first one is called St. Thomas Aquinas, who makes a short brief appearance in the poem. "I left parts of myself everywhere, the way absent-minded people leave gloves and umbrellas, whose colors are sad from dispensing so much bad luck. I was in a park bench asleep. It was like the art of ancient Egypt. I didn't wish to bestir myself. I made my long shadow take the evening train. We give death to a child when we give it a doll, said the woman who had read Juna Barnes. We whispered all night. She had traveled to darkest Africa. She had many stories to tell about the jungle. I was already in New York looking for work. It was raining as in the days of Noah. I stood in many doorways of that great city. Once I asked a man in a tuxedo for a cigarette. He gave me a frightened look and walked away into the rain. Since man naturally desires happiness, according to St. Thomas Aquinas, who gave irrefutable proof of God's existence and purpose, I loaded trucks in the garment center. Me and a black man stole a woman's red dress. It was of silk. It shimmered. Upon a gloomy night, with all our loving ardors on fire, we carried it down the long, empty avenue, each holding one sleeve. The heat was intolerable, causing many terrifying human faces to come out of hiding. In the public library reading room, there was a single ceiling fan barely turning. I had the travels of Herman Melville to serve me as a pillow. I was on a ghost ship with its sails fully raised. I could see no land anywhere. The sea and its monsters could not cool me. I followed a saintly looking nurse into a doctor's office. We edged past people with eyes and ears bandaged. I'm a medieval philosopher in exile, I explained to my landlady that night. And truly, I no longer look like myself. I wore glasses with a nasty spider crack over one eye. I stayed in the movies all day long. A woman on the screen walked through a bombed city again and again. She wore army boots. Her legs were long and bare. It was cold, whatever she was. She had her back turned to me, but I was in love with her. I expected to find wartime Europe at the exit. It wasn't even snowing. Everyone I met wore a part of my destiny like a carnival mask. I'm Bartleby the Scrivener, I told the Italian waiter. Me too, he replied. And I could see nothing but overflowing ashtrays the human face flies were busy examining. This next one is called Shelley. I thought it was the night that I discovered Shelley in a big way. I mean, I had read Shelley before a little bit, and so I think it's all clear because it tells a story.
Could you
go a little louder? Yes. Me and Shelley. It's actually the poem is called Shelley. Poet of the dead leaves, driven like ghosts, driven like pestilence-stricken multitudes. I read you first one rainy evening in New York City, in my atrocious Slavic accent, saying the mellifluous verses from a battered, much-stained volume I had bought earlier that day in a second-hand bookstore on Fourth Avenue, run by an initiate of the occult masters. The little money I had being almost spent, I walked the streets, my nose in the book. I sat in a dingy coffee shop with last summer's dead flies on the table. The owner was an ex-sailor who had grown a huge hump on his back while watching the rain, the empty street. He was glad to have me sit and read. He had refilled my cup with a liquid dark as river Styx. Shelley spoke of a mad, blind, dying king, of rulers who neither see nor feel nor know, of grace from which a glorious phantom may burst to illumine our tempestuous day. I too felt like a glorious phantom going to have my dinner in a Chinese restaurant I knew so well. It had a three-fingered waiter who would bring my soup and rice each night, without ever saying a word. I never saw anyone else there. The kitchen was separated by a curtain of glass beads which clicked faintly whenever the front door opened. The front door opened that evening to admit a pale little girl with glasses. The poet spoke of the everlasting universe of things, of gleams of an immortal world which visit the soul in sleep, of a desert people by storms alone. The streets were strewn with broken umbrellas, which looked like funereal kites the little Chinese girl might have made. The bars on McDougal Street were emptying. There had been a fist fight. A man leaned against the lamppost, arms extended as if crucified, the rain washing the blood off his face. In a dimly lit side street where the sidewalk was like a ballroom mirror at closing time, a well-dressed man without any shoes asked me for money. His eyes shone, he looked triumphant, like a fencing master who had just struck a mortal blow. How strange it all was, the world's raffle that dark October night. The yellowed volume of poetry with its splendors and glooms, which I studied by the light of storefronts, drugstores, and barbershops, afraid of my small windowless room, cold as a tomb of an infant emperor. Let's see. This is not a New York poem, same period. It's called Paradise. In a neighborhood once called Hell's Kitchen, where a beggar claimed to be playing Nero's fiddle while the city burned in midsummer heat, where a lady barber who called herself Cleopatra wielded the scissors of fate over my head, threatening to cut off my ears and nose, when a man and a woman went walking naked in one of the dark side streets at dawn. I must be dreaming, I told myself. It was like meeting a couple of sphinxes. I expected them to have wings, bodies of lions, him with his wildly tattooed chest, her with her huge dangling breasts. It happened so quickly and so long ago. You know that time just before the day breaks, when one yearns to lie down on cool sheets in a room with shades drawn. The hour when the beautiful suicides lying side by side in the morgue get up and walk out into the first light. The curtains of cheap hotels flying out of windows like seagulls, but everything else quiet. Steam rising out of the subway gratings, bodies glistening with sweat, madness, and you might even say paradise. Oh, this is different. This is called In the Library. It's one of those poems that the title sort of runs in, you know, becomes part of the poem, first line of the poem. In the library, there is a book called A Dictionary of Angels. No one has opened it in 50 years. I know, because when I did, the covers creaked, the pages crumbled. There I discovered the angels were once as plentiful as species of flies. The sky at dusk used to be thick with them. You had to wave both arms just to keep them away. Now the sun is shining through the tall windows. The library is a quiet place. Angels and gods huddled in dark, unopened books. The great secret lies on some shelf Miss Jones passes every day on her rounds. She's very tall, so she keeps her head tipped as if listening. The books are whispering. I hear nothing, but she does. a poem called Death the Philosopher. These are all from the new book. He in the poem is Death, Death the Philosopher. He gives excellent advice by example. See, he says, see that? And he doesn't have to open his mouth to tell you what. You can trust his vast experience. Still, there is no huff in him. Once he had a most unfortunate passion. It came to an end. He loved the way the summer dusk fell. He wanted to have it falling forever. It was not possible. That was the big secret. It's dreadful when things get as bad as that. But then they don't. He got the point, and so, one day, miraculously lucid, you too came to ask about the strangeness of it all. Charles, you said, how strange you should be here at all. A poem called, I guess it's also an evening poem. In fact, I have two or three evening poems here. It's evening, so, you know. This is called The White Room. And well, it's kind of a poem about solitude. And at some point, Emily Dickinson makes an appearance, sort of exits without slamming the door, you know. I don't know. The White Room. The obvious is difficult to prove. Many prefer the hidden. I did too. I listened to the trees. They had a secret which they were about to make known to me and then didn't. Summer came. Each tree on my street had its own Scheherazade. My nights were a part of their wild storytelling. We were entering dark houses, more and more dark houses, hushed and abandoned. There was someone with eyes closed on the upper floors. The thought of it and the wonder kept me sleepless. The truth is bold and cold, said a woman who always wore white. She didn't leave her room much. The sun pointed to one or two things that had survived the long night intact, the simplest things, difficult in their obviousness. They made no noise. It was the kind of day people describe as perfect. Gods disguising themselves as black hairpins, a hand mirror, a comb with a tooth missing. No, that wasn't it. Just things as they are, unblinking, lying mute in that bright light, and the trees waiting for the night. A couple more poems. Let's see. This is called Childhood Story. The streets were wider, the houses bigger. A red-haired giantess with huge breasts took you into her bed. There you heard again the story of the king's youngest daughter. The ball she played with rolled into a pond full of dead leaves. It stayed there. You already knew you'd find it someday. You'd enter a quiet, sun-burnished room, and there'd be that ball on the table. It was black from spending so much time in other people's dreams. You told no one about it. The earth is a ball, you heard your father say. He sat in a lion-footed chair with a sheet over his head, as if waiting for movers. The roads out of town were packed with sleepwalkers dressed as soldiers. They must not be wakened, you were warned. Was it true that they always drew the victim's name out of a hat? That they were forbidden rooms only bad children and mad housewives entered? That the ball in the story was said to be golden? Evening Talk. This is the final poem. Everything you didn't understand made you what you are. Strangers whose eye you caught on the street studying you. Perhaps they were the all-seeing Illuminati. They knew what you didn't and left you troubled like a strange dream. Not even the light stayed the same. Where did all that hard glare come from? And the scent, as if mythical beings were being groomed and fed stalks of hay on these roofs scattered among the evening clouds. You didn't understand the thing. You loved the crowds at the end of the day that brought you so many mysteries. There was always someone you were meant to meet who for some reason wasn't waiting. Or perhaps they were, but not here, friend. You should have crossed the street and followed that obviously demented woman with the long streak of blood-red hair, which the sky took up like a distant cry. Thank you.
Well, our evening has drawn to a close, and I would just one last time like to thank our four reading poets this evening, Charles Simic, Maxine Kuman, Jane Kenyon, and Donald Hall. And I must also thank you, the audience. I think I speak for everyone involved with the New Hampshire Writers and Publishers Project to say that this is such a fitting first anniversary for us, and that it is so gratifying to see so many people interested in listening to fine poetry in the state of New Hampshire. I think that as long as there are poets to read and listeners to hear, we cannot really go far wrong in this state. Thank you very much.
This program was recorded Friday, September 15th by WEVO.